From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in a hospital with a conversation between a patient and a nurse. The day before, the patient had given birth to a baby girl by cesarean section. The mother had a history of pulmonary embolisms, so when she began to feel short of breath, she told a nurse between gasps that she needed a CT scan. The nurse dismissed her concerns, saying her pain medicine was just making her confused. But the patient persisted. After multiple attempts to have the medical team heed her request, she finally got a CT scan, and it revealed several blood clots in her lungs. The patient said, quote, "Listen to Dr. Williams." Dr. Serena Williams, that is. The patient was tennis star Serena Williams. She shared this story with Vogue in 2018. As reported by Vox, Williams' story sheds light on the health risks that come with childbirth, but also on the racial bias in the medical field that can lead to life-threatening issues. Research shows black women are 2 to 4 times more likely than white women to die from pregnancy-related complications, and many of these deaths are largely preventable. Many women of color say their concerns are dismissed, ignored, or minimized by doctors. So what can be done to eliminate systemic racism in the medical system and create better outcomes for women of color? State Senator Summer Brook has been considering this issue from the legislative side. She joins us this hour, along with local experts in the medical field, to discuss how to address these disparities. And I'd like to welcome our guest now. State Senator Summer Brook, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan. Thanks for having this conversation.
And hello to Dr. Twyla Dillion, who is Executive Director of Health Connect One. Twyla, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Sherita Bullock is Executive Director of the Healthy Baby Network. Sherita, welcome. Thank you for being with us.
Evan, thank you so much for having me.
And let me ask both of you to describe what your organizations are doing. Sherita, tell me about the Healthy Baby Network.
So the Healthy Baby Network this year is celebrating 25 years of service to our Rochester community. I'm grateful to have been here for 24. And we've always focused on efforts to improve maternal child health. Over recent years, we've gone from working more structurally with systems to look at systems improvement to providing some direct service in addition to doing that work. So we have a team of people here, including outreach workers who are out in the community every day looking for pregnant and parenting parents who need help and support. We have a fatherhood program that provides services directly to men and to fathers in our community, understanding that they are key influencers in providing health support and protection and care in the development of their children. And then working with moms to provide prenatal education and preparation, delivery support, and postpartum. To that complement, we also add doulas through our Black Doula Collaborative to provide doula support to families that desire one, and really all towards the goal of preventing and then eliminating preventable maternal mortality and severe morbidity.
All right. And Twyla, can you describe Health Connect One and what your work entails?
Absolutely. So our organization is national, and we elevate the knowledge that birth equity is fundamental to racial equity. Our work focuses on Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities, and for over 30 years, we've worked with maternal child health organizations, hospitals, and grassroots organizations to co-design customized, community-based, peer-to-peer support programs for birthing families, including community-based doulas, breastfeeding peer counselors, and community health workers. Additionally, we partner with these birth workers and community-based organizations to advance the perinatal community health worker field and call for fair pay as we elevate community voice and advocacy around legislation that is in support of birth equity.
All right. Well, I appreciate having both of you. And let me ask the senator from the outset here, Senator Brook, this has been an issue that has been on your radars from the beginning of your tenure here and something that you've talked a lot about. Let me read a little bit of data, and then I want to ask you how it really ended up on your radar first and what you think is sort of realistic about what can be done here. So in the data, ProPublica, in all, Black women are 243% more likely than white women to die from pregnancy or childbirth-related causes producing one of the largest racial disparities in women's health. From the New York Times, black women in America have more than a 3 times higher risk of death related to pregnancy, regardless of factors like higher education and financial means. And for women over 30, the risk is as much as 5 times higher. And I'm going to say that again, the New York Times pointing out this is not just about class or income. Regardless of factors like higher education and financial means, and 5 times more for women over 30. And the New York State Health Foundation, in 2018, the rate of severe complications for black women delivering was 447 per 10,000 deliveries, 2.3 times higher than among white women, for whom the rate was 191 per 10,000 deliveries. Senator Brooke, how did this first really kind of come into your sensibility as to an issue that you wanted to address? Take me through that and then kind of set the course here for what can be done.
Absolutely. And I'm just so grateful to be having this conversation. And I have to say thank you to Dr. Jillian and Sharita for being here. As they just both outlined, their work is massive and all-encompassing. So to take this time and, you know, really have experts here to talk about it for people who are wondering is just fantastic. And I'm happy to be here from my perspective as well. So we can start with the very clear, obvious thing. I am a black woman living in America. So whether or not, you know, the disparities in the statistics, you know, I was aware of for years and years, I certainly was a black woman trying to navigate a healthcare system. And even before being of, you know, a childbearing age, there are things that you notice. There's things you notice in your care. There's things that you talk to your other friends about and say, is this what your experience was? Or you think it's just you? And then, you know, when you get to a point where you're able to read these kinds of statistics and hear these kinds of stories and talk to leaders like we have on the call, you start to realize this is obviously a much, much bigger issue. But the first time I heard about the specific statistics around maternal mortality for black mothers was actually a good 5 or 6 years ago. And I listened to the statistic that said where the U.S. ranked with overall maternal mortality, and I thought that they had accidentally reversed the order of that statistic because we were so high on mortality rate, which is a bad thing because you don't want a high rate of maternal mortality, that I assumed that they had, you know, the stat must have been messed up. And so I dug deeper only to realize, wow, the United States as a whole is not doing a good job with taking care of our mothers. And to think of us as this advanced, you know, technology-driven society and that we're still not doing that well, was something that opened my eyes. And so being in this position now, fast forward 5, 6 years, and the beginning of my tenure here as a state senator, you know, part of being in this job is not just using your own experience, you know, to impact the change that you want to drive, but also using your, you know, your platform to educate and to raise awareness. So so that's why we decided to really commemorate National Black Maternal Health Week, which was April 11th through the 17th. But of course, we're in Minority Health Month for the month of April, to really use that as a chance to educate people on this issue, because we can't solve this just with black mothers or black pregnant people. We have to solve this as an entire healthcare system. And so my hope is that we can convene more and more people to understand this issue, to help us in the fight, to make sure these mothers and their babies are staying alive, and to have a deeper understanding of what people are facing. Like you said, Evan, regardless of income, you quoted Serena Williams' story. I mean, Beyonce, I mean, these are names of people who we all love and admire and are, you know, they inspire us, and yet they're dealing with these same issues.
Yeah, and Senator Brooke, I wanted to ask you about the Serena Williams story, because I'm sure there are some listeners who heard that story and their first reaction might be, well, come on, this could have happened to any mother in that situation. It doesn't have to be a black woman. It doesn't matter. Like, this person, the nurse, might have said that to a white woman, to an Asian woman, to anybody. And, you know, it's impossible maybe to prove a single anecdote proves the data, but the data is the data. And the data does reflect that Serena Williams was more likely to have been ignored for the concerns she was vocalizing right there than a white woman. That is what the data says. So regardless of whether we know for a fact that that's why that happened with Serena Williams, the data indicates she's more likely. And I think people probably struggle to grapple with that, because often I do think often, Senator Brook, when we talk about racial justice, class doesn't always get brought up, and sometimes to the detriment of the conversation, and sometimes I don't do a very good job of that. But this is one of those ones that transcends class. Do you think people struggle with that, that to understand that even Serena Williams might be dismissed or ignored in that spot?
You know, it's a great question, and I think people – it's hard as humans, right, the way our brains work, the way we create schemas and how we see the world. It's always going to be hard to step outside of our own experience and to understand what someone else's experience might be like. And, you know, this is the same, very similar to the conversation that we've been having for the past, oh my gosh, over a year now with COVID-19, right? And we've had very blunt conversations around looking at data of who's dying at a higher rate, who's getting infected at a higher rate, whether it goes along lines of zip code and race and income. And there's so many determinants of that. But, you know, I think we're getting better at having these conversations. And part of that is because, and this is something that New York State did, which was creating this task force around maternal mortality and actually studying the data, because a lot of what happens is kind of this gaslighting, right, of, well, that's one example, that's another example, it might be isolated, but we all know who are experiencing it. We know that we've talked to other people and we know what's happening. So oftentimes you need a state government or, you know, some entity like that to say, you know what, this is a big enough issue, we're going to put resources towards this, we're going to do the reporting, and we have the data now. And you've given multiple sightings of data. And I think people are getting more and more used to understanding that even if it's not your exact experience or someone you know, you can't deny, you know, when tens of thousands of people are, you know, their experiences are being highlighted through these data sets, that there are major discrepancies.
Yeah, and we'll talk throughout this hour about the various suggestions, because whether it's in New York Times, Vox, Vogue, so many other sources, the New York State Health Foundation, there's a long list of suggestions on what to do about how to change this. And, of course, Senator Brook is here talking about how she sees perhaps state government's job. But Dr. Dillian, when you look at just the numbers, Twyla, I'm wondering if you think – that this starts with just needing to hire more Black doctors, more Black nurses, more Black healthcare workers.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely agree we need to do that. We also need to have better pipelines for people to actually get those sorts of jobs.
Yeah.
This problem is not, it's not a single issue, right? This is very multifaceted. The fact that there are massive inequities in access to education, which serves as a barrier to actually being able to be in those roles, that's something that clearly needs to be discussed. But from a statistical perspective, this is really a matter of urgency. And there are many mechanisms that can help to alleviate some of these challenges or at least provide support to Black women while they're in this perinatal period, including doulas, which I know we're going to speak about. Statistically, if we want to look at this in a more blatant way, the U.S. ranks around 56th among nations as far as maternal mortality, rather. If we looked at the Black community as a country, we would rank 86th. So that really points to the fact that this is a massive inequity that needs to be addressed, and we can't, unfortunately, snap our fingers and have more Black clinicians, right? And that wouldn't necessarily solve the issue, because it's really a systemic issue, even in the way that Black and brown clinicians are educated, right? So the educational system is fraught with peril when it comes to, you know, how folks are being educated to work with Black women, even understanding and appreciate the pain that we express when we're in labor or in other healthcare situations.
Yeah, we are going to talk about doulas in just a moment and so many of these other, you know, possible interventions. Sherita Bullock, do you see hiring more Black people to be in the healthcare system? And I take Twyla's point. I mean, you got to create a pipeline, and that takes a lot of work and effort, especially considering decades of a system that's sort of stacked against, you know, in some ways, Black people from entering certain professions. But how much does that rise to the top of the list for you, Sherita, of things that would help?
Yep, it certainly is a strategy in the toolbox of strategies that we need to apply. To Dr. Dillian's point, this is a multifaceted, multi-layers of complications issue. And so our response really requires us to have multiple responses and targets and strategies. So certainly hiring more and having more Black medical professionals and researchers is part of the answer. Part of the answer really is working with our existing pool of providers to be more competent when it comes to working with Black and brown families. And so part of this is also acknowledging not just structural racism that's embedded in our medical system, but the bias of our providers. And because the nature of bias is that you don't see it and you don't always know when it's operating, it's really difficult to sort of capture it, identify it when it's operating, and then begin to do something different in the immediate. So while we are also, you know, really working on frameworks to work with providers, we also find that we have to educate parents, adults before they are parents, and family members around pregnant people about how to recognize when something is going wrong during pregnancy or delivery. Who are the people that you should talk to? What's the order that you should go in? Who do you talk to first and then what? And then when do you go and get other help that might reside outside of the healthcare system, which is certainly part of the role of doulas to help arm families with that knowledge and those supports so that, you know, you were talking about Serena Williams' story, and that's a great example of the morbidity or the near misses, but we also have to talk about the mortalities of when we actually lose moms. And so what are the strategies to prevent those preventable deaths and the preventable near misses so that we can send babies home with their moms, we can send partners home with their spouses, families home with their family member, and we see these same types of, you know, it's not one or the other, it's both and. So our approaches really are to do that kind of work to be sure that Black maternal mortality and morbidity is a topic that is discussed throughout our community more than Black Maternal Health Week, more than Minority Health Month, that it's something that we as a community focus on because these near misses and the deaths cost our entire community. This is not a Black issue. It's not a Black health issue. This is a community crisis.
Well, you have brought up doulas a couple times. Let's talk about doulas for a second here, Sharita. So about a decade ago when my son was coming along and he was, you know, before he was born, I don't think I had ever really understood what a doula is. And it was described to me like this. If doulas were a medicine, it would be illegal not to prescribe it. That's how beneficial they can be. So I thought, well, we definitely want one of those. And it, shout out to the doulas who do great work. It's just phenomenal what they can do in a constructive sort of team kind of setting. But I'd also, you know, looking back, I wonder, Sharita, you know, is this something that is available for people of who have means, who tend to be, not exclusively, but tend to skew white? And, you know, is this something that can be more egalitarian, more accessible for everybody, Sharita?
So that's exactly what we're working to do, to make doulas accessible to everyone who would want one, focusing in on Black and brown families where we see the most dramatic health consequences. So doulas are people who are certified through any number of organizations to go through and provide some pregnancy preparation with families. You can have a doula who only attends the birth to provide birth support or just postpartum. Doula services range anywhere from $500 up to $3,000, depending on how long that doula has been practicing, where her specialties are, or sometimes how she functions and works. And so for many people, that is out of range of possibility. So our doulas are providing services to the families that they're working with free of charge. And while we are not, we have one doula who's here on staff who does some deliveries but is also working with our Black Doula Collaborative, we're providing stipends which do nothing really to get at the cost of what it costs to have a doula, but really just provide some of the hospital amenities, parking, a meal, and helping to arrange childcare for their own children while they're helping to deliver other children. This is really about helping parents have a birth plan. So what is it that mom wants to have happen? What medications does she want, does she not want? What happens when something arises that's outside of what we would call normal or typical birth? And so how do we keep families engaged? How do we keep them knowledgeable about what's happening? And how do we keep their birth experience as close as possible to their birth plan? And then when we shift into the postpartum period, it's really about helping the family or whoever is around mom and how that family shows up. Some folks have traditional families, but others not so much. Their families look a little different. And so we want to make provisions for all the ways that families show up to really embrace that mom and baby and that dad and the immediate family in the support of welcoming that child into their setting, being sure that mom has all the support that she needs if she chooses to breastfeed, being sure that her care is happening afterwards, that her bleeding is the appropriate amount of bleeding, that she's comfortable, that she's not experiencing pain. And when things start to be a little different from that, when there is prolonged bleeding or heavy bleeding or lots of pain, that mom has the language and someone with her to help her communicate with a medical provider. I think one of the most interesting things about this issue is that when you talk to families who've experienced the death, they say, we knew that something was going on, but we could not use the right words with the right urgency to get our medical provider to act. When you talk to medical providers, our medical providers tell us that these are situations where there was a health condition that either was unattended to before pregnancy or arose during pregnancy. And what we saw was that the death was the consequences of that bad health prior to pregnancy or that condition not being managed well prior to pregnancy. So I come at this as not a mom who's had a baby recently or not a medical professional asking how can these two things worlds apart all exist at once and why is this such a common theme? And so we are careful not to, you know, point fingers or accuse providers, but really work to understand how do we engage everyone that touches on pregnancy and birth to really understand what are the driving factors and courses? How do we get people to hear what families and moms are saying? How do we address bias? How do we address systemic structural racism and the practices and how they play out, but also the people who enforce those practices? And how do we humanize this situation and birth in a way that there are, you know, when a mom says something doesn't feel right, that data is considered the same way a medical test would be examined. That mom saying something doesn't feel right or I have blood in my urine, this is unusual. How do we get that data to weigh as much as a test result? And then to act in the same way that we would act on a medical diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Twyla, how do you see the question of doulas, for example?
Yeah, so I definitely wanted to piggyback on that. So we know that it's critical to have someone who can hear you, right? Trina and I have partnered on work where we've talked to Black moms locally in Rochester to understand what their experiences were. And one of the prevailing themes was that they did not, one, feel that they were being listened to by providers. And we've heard that, I think, across the country. We've seen this slogan, listen to women, listen to Black women, right? That's something that we've heard over and over again, but we're still having a lot of these same outcomes. Another thing that we learned was that folks didn't feel like they'd been educated appropriately about what they would experience during the perinatal period, whether that was because they didn't feel, again, listened to or that their needs were being dismissed in a clinical setting. One of the really critical parts that a doula plays in this birthing experience is helping moms to know how to better advocate for themselves and also serving as a partner in that advocacy in clinical settings of all kinds. And even when mom's at home, right, maybe it's time to call the doctor. Here are the kinds of questions you should ask. What questions do you think you should ask? So really being that support that is in addition to support that they already have. I have to point out as well, Evan, that maternal deaths, 40 to 60% of them are preventable, right? So as you said earlier, that not allowing for people to have doulas would be illegal if it was a medicine, that statistic alone should really point to why it's so critical to have doulas in the room. They are reducing the likelihood of cesarean, reducing the likelihood of epidural, and really ensuring that moms stick to that birth plan and that their voices are heard. Listening is, as Sherita said, as valid and should be considered as valid. Mothers' voices should be considered as valid as a test. They know what their body feels like. They know when something's not right. And that has been the prevailing theme that we've heard as we've talked to moms. So doulas really do fit into that space as serving as an educator and an advocate. They are not clinical providers, and I can't state that enough. They're there specifically to support that mom. And for Black moms whose voices often aren't heard and whose pain is often not considered serious, that is a really critical component that is missing for a lot of people.
And Twyla, just briefly, before we take our only break of the hour, and then we are going to talk to Senator Brook about what the legislative remedies may be. I'm going to go over some of the proposals I've seen out there for what interactions with doctors and healthcare settings may be and directly how that may change. We'll see what our guests say about that. But Twyla, when we think about whether it's Serena Williams' story or so many others of Black women who, you know, as you mentioned, maybe they end up with a C-section when they don't necessarily need it or maybe shouldn't have it. Maybe they don't they vocalize a concern about breathing or blood and urine and it's sort of ignored. You know, it's not that I certainly don't think the vast majority of people, probably all of them who work in a healthcare setting, they don't want bad outcomes. They don't want patients to die. So is it simply sort of what we would call, I guess, a form of implicit bias, maybe an unrecognized stereotyping that happens in these settings to Black women more so than others?
Absolutely. So I would call it, I'd go a step further. So in certain instances, it's explicit racism, right? So I, even in the birthing of my children, I've had experiences where I'm talked to as if I don't understand certain things. Mm. Luckily I do, but I have a PhD, right? So this is something that transcends class, it transcends income. It's something that really is about that patient-provider experience, right? What is that relationship like? And what's happening in that interaction? Folks, sometimes it is implicit, but there are times where it is just so apparent and obvious. And as I stated earlier, this is multifaceted in that some of how folks have been educated is just full of different racist ideologies and thoughts. You know, the way that we convey idea of Black being a risk factor. I can't tell you the number of times that I've had to state over and over that that's not the case in a doctoral education setting. So if that's how folks are being educated and it's basically sinking into their brain, when they're providing care, they are thinking in their head that this person in front of me is a risk factor. There's something wrong with this person, right? Whether they really recognize that or not, it's something that is definitely existing in our educational process. So it's hard to pin it down on one thing, but I definitely think we can state without any confusion that the outcomes that are so inequitable for Black women are a byproduct of racism in this country.
We're talking about the fact that Black women are 2 to 4 times more likely than white women to die from pregnancy-related complications, and many of these deaths are essentially preventable. Our guests have been saying 40% to 60%. So if you take the middle of that, maybe half the deaths shouldn't happen. There are other complications that tend to sometimes get ignored, shouldn't happen. So the question is, how does this change? You just heard Dr. Twyla Dillion, who is Executive Director of Health Connect One. Sherita Bullock, Executive Director of the Healthy Baby Network, is with us. And State Senator Sommer Brook with us. And we are right back talking solutions to this on the other side of this only break. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, 89 people short. That's what New York State was. And as a result, with the census problems, we don't have enough people to keep the same number of seats in Congress. We're losing one. We're talking redistricting, what it means, what comes next. And then I'm a migraine sufferer. We're talking to the author of a new book on migraine, coming up on Connections on Friday.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Two Point Capital Management, an investment firm using a proprietary discipline to help people manage financial risk in good times and in bad. Two Point Capital Management, discover a richer world. TwoPointCapital.com.
What if, instead of $15 across the board, the federal minimum wage was variable based on local economic data? What if, indeed? That story next time on Marketplace.
this evening at 6:30.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I should have done a little clarifying. Every time I've heard Jim Gaffigan talk about the fact that he and his wife have five children and they employed a midwife, he says people usually say, "Oh, I didn't know you gave birth in a tent in your backyard." And he says, "Okay, hold on. Let's talk about what this actually means. It means a lot of different things here. So if you have an expectation of doula or midwife, et cetera," Todd writes to say, "Evan, great program, but can you explain the difference between midwife and doula?" And Twyla, can you do that?
So a midwife is a clinical provider. So a lot of midwives, not all, but a lot of midwives are trained as nurses, and they go on to have specified training as a clinical nurse midwife. So they're nurses, many, not all. There are some lay midwives as well, but that's the vast majority across the country that are actually reimbursable by insurance. Doulas are there specifically to support mom. They do not have clinical training. They do not do any clinical procedures. They're there genuinely as support for mom. So they're very different roles. I hope that's helpful.
Yep, very different. Just someone who is there, the doula supporting the process. And generally, my experience, worked with you to find out what your goals are, what your expectations are. Sometimes we'll work on pain alleviation and all kinds of other things, just communication, just helpful communication, just part of the team. And a very, yep. very effective thing, especially as stressful as that can be, right, Twyla? I mean, that situation can be very stressful, and doulas can be very good at handling that.
Absolutely. So I've had doulas with my last two births, so speaking as a Black mom, and I definitely appreciated and needed that support to get into the right position. We used no drugs at all in our births. We walked around to bring on labor. So really doing things that are outside of the clinical treatments that help to, you know, make labor more comfortable for mom and supporting mom after the baby's been born as well. I remember taking a nap because the doula was there to hold the baby. The doula also supported my husband, right? So that's something else that's critical to point out. I know Sherita pointed out the different ways that families show up, but, you know, doulas are really essential in that as well, you know, advocating not just for mom, but for the family when they're in these spaces and in these settings. So definitely, you know, critical to provide that kind of support.
So, Senator Brooke, what are the legislative remedies that you think are within reach here?
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, I think it is a big step that New York's, I mean, it's never enough. This is why, you know, we're in this position. That's why we're having this conversation, because there's a lot more to do. But, you know, as the first step, I think, as I said before, so much of, and just my crash course in the first 4 months of this job as a senator, so much of what we want to change in terms of government, oftentimes something has to be studied, right? So you've got to be able to show with numbers. And I know we've got Twyla here with all the numbers and statistics that we need. And so having, you know, this task force put in place a couple of years ago with the state, that was huge, because that was able to really put forth a number of recommendations that should be taken into place, so, or taken into account. So one of them, I want to continue on the conversation around doulas. You know, I have to go back to what you said, Evan, and I think you said it so well. I'm going to paraphrase because I may have forgotten your exact line, but you said if doulas were a medicine, it would be wrong not to prescribe to everyone.
Yeah, that's what
like
I was
that.
Told a decade ago, that right. You know, if doulas were a form of medication, it would be illegal not to prescribe it. That's what I was told.
Not to prescribe. Yeah, and that's powerful, though, right? And you know, from just thinking about how important having that person is in that role to, you know, dramatically increase outcomes for maternal and baby health. You know, a couple of weeks ago when we did Black Maternal Health Week, we talked to a lot of doctors, and that was, you know, one of the things I pulled away was so many of those providers said a doula is a huge way today that can help Black mothers increase their own outcomes, right? That's something that if they have the means or have an organization like the Healthy Baby Network to provide that for them, that is something that can really, really dramatically increase outcomes. So one of the things that happened at the state level was doing this piloting program to expand Medicaid coverage for doulas. So as we've heard, Sherita laid out that there are there's various costs with doulas, right? It could be hundreds or thousands for people. And based on what's available to you in your community, unless you do have the income level where you could afford that, you're basically precluded from being able to have this thing that so many people admit is an immediate way to increase an outcome while we deal with all of these other pieces. So that is a pilot program that happened in 2019. We are now, certainly my team specifically, is looking at how do we take the learnings from that, and is that something that we could make permanent? How do we ensure that the people that are able to serve people in this life-saving way are actually getting the reimbursement they need, which also allows them to be in business? Because let's just listen to what Sharita just said, and if I remember hearing it correctly, some of these doulas are essentially volunteering their time for some mothers, where maybe they get money to get a babysitter and dinner for their kids. But, I mean, these are professionals who should be treated as professionals. So that's one thing that that we're looking at. And I would say, you know, another big thing is we do have our maternal mortality board. And that is a board that is now in place in New York State to be studying this issue and to make sure that our trends are not going in the wrong direction, which, by the way, over several decades had been going up in these disparities. The other thing is we talk about the role of the field of medicine, right, and the providers, who has access to this education, who's making it not just through their undergrad but through med school and on to their residency and placed and, you know, on to becoming, you know, an OBGYN or going to nurse school to become a certified nurse midwife or, you know, going to school to be a doula, all of these things. We know we have a diversity problem. And, you know, I'm the chair of mental health. I'm dealing with the same thing in our mental health through those programs and needing to diversify. This is a problem that is through almost every professional sector in the U.S., frankly. And so there are a lot of things that we can also do there. You know, how do we make sure that cultural competency is taught in medical schools? We can legislate that. I would love for medical schools to take that on themselves. But, you know, this is the point where when we have a crisis to this level, you know, government has to act. And so those are all things that we are actively looking at as we wade through how to, you know, reach out to these sectors, talk to these medical centers, and really think about, you know, what legislative actions might we take as a legislature to make sure that what needs to get done gets done.
Are your colleagues on board?
My colleagues on the call or in the Senate?
No, I mean in the Senate. I mean, do you feel like you've got legislative momentum? Yeah.
Well, I mean, I would say look at this task force, right? That was 2 years ago, and I think the governor put $8 million, you know, towards this issue. You know, Senator Rivera, the health committee chair, was the sponsor for some of this legislation that predates my time in the Senate. So I think especially the state Senate is especially aware of these issues. They want to act on these issues, and they have been acting, I believe, with this mindset of racial injustice in this country, whether it's from police reform to mental health reform to, you know, maternal mortality and things that we need to do. So I think enough people in New York State understand this is an issue, and I think certainly our legislature understands that this is an issue, and I would expect support from my colleagues for any new legislative actions that we put together in terms of bills to help tackle this.
So reading from the New York Times, a suggestion, a list of suggestions that at least in the interim to fixing things sort of systemically, these are some things that potential patients may need to know. Number one, what should doctors and patients do? Number one, address racism starting in the waiting room. The following sample language could help. Quote, I recently read that black women like me have a much higher chance of death related to pregnancy and childbirth than white women. That's really scary. What do you think about these statistics, and how can we work together to prevent that from happening? End quote. Sharita, what do you think? Is that a good way to be direct and address it?
I think it's one of the ways that we start, but swimming a little further upstream to your point earlier about including this in the training of medical providers. There's some piece of this that is a light now because of the urgency, so this is not about training the professionals who are up and coming, but really opening pathways for conversation around difficult conversations around race, racism, equity, and social justice with our current providers, and then doing something that is institutionalized in our systems for upcoming providers. I think that we also need to be sure that we've got pathways for high school students to work into to work into medical professional careers. And I think that, you know, as we talk about patient-provider relationships, Dr. Dillion talked about some of the work that we had done and moms feeling like they're not heard. That issue is ripe for improving and strengthening the relationships between moms and providers. And I would almost like to see providers lead with engaging moms with some of these conversations versus putting the responsibility on moms. And so we, you know, again, this comes back to not doing one or the other, but really doing multiple things and having multiple strategies within our toolboxes so that we, you know, can prevent the near misses, but most especially the mortality.
Yeah, and so I'll read the full list here. So that was suggestion number one. There are four. Number two, create a care plan anticipating that racism may impact pregnancy. Research from AMA Journal of Ethics suggests that people who experience systemic racism may internalize this into physical manifestations, including higher blood pressure, hypertension, and higher rates of heart disease. 57% of black women have hypertension compared with 37% of white women. Number three, identify how racism may impact labor. Studies from the National Institute of Health have demonstrated that medical professionals have perceived black people as having higher pain tolerances, leading to disparities in pain management that cannot be explained by perceived lesser pain. And number four, identify how racism may impact postpartum. Up to 45% of maternal deaths happen in the weeks after delivery, a time where people are generally more removed from medical care and their regular support systems. Anything you want to add there, Sherita? What do you think of those suggestions?
Yeah, I again, would champion all of them and, you know, really want to go back to and highlight the fact that people think that there is this prevailing notion that racism is a thing of the past. And we, you know, often hear comments like, why don't black people just get over it? And part of the reason that, you know, that's just not possible is because so many of the systems, and we're talking specifically about healthcare here, so much of the work in terms of the actual practice, the training, the books and documentation are embedded in systems that already have issues around race and ethnicity. So this is really about, you know, if we were going to look at addressing practice, addressing training, and then looking at the systems, the structures, and the policies around it so that we can have better outcomes across the board.
Okay. Twyla Dillion, what do you think about the New York Times collection of experts' suggestions on what doctors and patients should do?
I think the suggestions are great, but something that is missing that's of critical importance is this accountability. So really acknowledging when things don't go well. There's an app that's recently came out formed by Kimberly Allers-Seals, which is called the Earth App. And it's basically like Yelp, but for women of color when they enter clinical settings, birthing settings, and listing different issues or experiences that they've had in different settings. So you can go and look for a particular hospital and then hear from women who maybe had their birth there and hear what their experience was like. I mean, it's unfortunate that in this country we need to develop an app like that. But I'm glad to see that it's been developed because it really allows for us to have this community where we're talking about things that maybe haven't necessarily gone so well. I've also heard of legislation at a federal level that I had a lot of feelings about, which was meant to penalize hospitals that had poor outcomes, so outcomes that showed these health disparities or where black women weren't treated appropriately. It shouldn't have to get to that level, but we definitely do have to have some level of accountability for clinical providers where if things don't go well, there's definitely at least elevating what those issues are and using that to do better. I have lots of feelings around cultural competence training and things like that. I think that this is something that needs to be embedded in all of the levels of how people are educated, even in some continuing education as time goes on, but really at a much more fundamental level, really to get past this, it's something that's so deep. It's a changing of hearts and minds that you can't do in a class. You can't do it in a webinar where you click through everything and then you're done. It really needs to be much more of a concerted effort than that. But I do agree with those recommendations. I just think we need to go a few levels deeper.
Yeah, and I want to talk to you a little bit more than about cultural competency training that mm-hmm. you mentioned. I think a lot of people hear that. And, you know, what comes to mind first, we've had a lot of conversations about that kind of training for white teachers in predominantly mm-hmm. black and brown classrooms, as an example. Mm-hmm. And there are, you know, routinely callers to this program who are skeptical that that kind of training can work. And then there are others who think they've seen it work, they've seen breakthroughs, but it takes real sort of effort and open minds to it. And, you know, I think when I read the first suggestion that the New York Times panel of experts had, you know, literally saying in the waiting room, saying directly to the staff, you know, as a black woman, I've heard I've got a much higher chance of death related to pregnancy and childbirth than white women. That's scary to me. What do you think about these statistics? How can we work together to prevent that? One of our listeners, Dave, just wrote me a note saying the wording there kind of sounds like, doc, please help me not die. I would have thought that that request was already implicit in all patient-physician interactions. And I think, Dave, I think what these experts are recommending is, I think what they're saying is, look, a lot of people haven't had, like, they don't have their heads around how serious this is. You may need to get them overtly thinking, don't screw this up, you know, as sort of like clumsy as that sounds here, because maybe there hasn't been the training. So do you think, Twyla, that competency training can work, get us past the point of literally sitting in the waiting room going, hey, I'm a black woman, make sure I don't die here?
I think we have to do all of it, right? So I've even heard in birth plans where if you're not being heard, you tell the provider, there's language you can use. You tell the provider, I do not feel safe, right? So there's certain language that, you know, certain doulas will tell their patients, like if we're out of patients, their clients, if we're having, you know, challenges with the clinician, you need to be very overt in your language. So what you described doesn't seem out of the realm of possibilities to me, because if you already are coming into a setting knowing, right, a pregnant woman right now, black pregnant woman right now knows all of these statistics, right? If they're paying attention to all of the news, they know these statistics, and it's really been made broadly available. I don't think that it's outside of the realm of possibility to do that. I think cultural competency training can only go so far, right? And for a lot of clinicians, and I mean this with all sincerity, for a lot of clinicians, it really is checking a box. It's not doing something that's really going to shift how they behave, because that's so deeply embedded in who they are. So we need to take a lot of different approaches to how we address this. And a lot of that is personal, you know, what is this individual who's carrying this baby, what are they doing to advocate for themselves? And to me, what you described sounds like that advocacy. It is, yes, very blunt, but it does sound like that advocacy. And it sounds like someone who is aware of what all the statistics are, which is a lot of black pregnant women right now.
Yeah. Sherita Bullock, are you confident that cultural competency training can work in various settings?
In short, no. I think it's so much more than cultural competency. And to Dave, I want to say to you that I know that we're focused on pregnancy, but I myself a few years ago had a reproductive procedure done. And I went in saying to them, because of the work that I do and knowing about the statistics, please don't kill me. I am important to this community. I know what this procedure is. I know the areas that it could go wrong. So please do this, 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 and this, because I know that every day people have, black women specifically, come in for minor procedures that people should walk away from and die. And I do not want to die. And I think that when we can begin to get everyone to understand that this is serious, that what's on the other side of racial health disparities that are preventable but are not attended to is death. And until we can get people to understand that, we don't want to kill people for seeking medical care. And this is not about blaming doctors or medical providers. This is about saying that there's work for all of us to do. There's work for all of us to do. And that there are some of us who are working day and night, night and day, but we still need others to come alongside and do things, to do things that are in support of black families. To do things that are in support of pregnancy, to be, you know, overall, at random acts of kindness towards pregnant women help, right? And I'm not saying that it needs to stop there by any means, but it's an entryway to say, when you see a woman moving through the community who is pregnant, do something to make her life better. And that's all of our responsibility. It doesn't fall only to medical providers, nor to Senator Baruch or to Dr. Dillian or to me or my staff here or any of their staff. This is a community issue, and that it's urgent because we're losing women.
So, Senator Baruch, what do you make of the calls that Dr. Dillian and others have made to make sure there is accountability in the healthcare setting? Again, not to sort of be overly punitive for no reason, but to be honest about, you know, repeated failures and repeated, frankly, disasters and tragedies. What does accountability look like to you?
I'll answer that. I also just have to point out just these two women both, I think, mothers as well, who have gone through this process but also choose to spend every waking moment when they're not caring for their own families to help other families. And, you know, I was speaking to a classroom today about what a senator does, and fourth grader asked me, what's the most important thing you do as a senator? And I said, listen. So I'm sitting here listening, because oftentimes communities will tell you the answer if you're willing to listen and then if you have the courage to act on it. And that's what I want to do around this issue specifically, and with any issue that the community is bringing up. And so, you know, I think it was Twyla who said, absolutely, the same way, let's go back to the fourth grader, right? The same way, you don't teach algebra the same way to every student. Some are audio learners, some are visual, some need to do it themselves, some will listen and do it and then do it later. Some need to go home and sleep on it to better understand it. You know, when we're talking about cultural competency and we're talking about these massive issues that have plagued our societies for so long, it's not going to be one thing that's going to solve it. I think that we always wish that people on their own would understand the importance of these things and act on it. When that doesn't happen, we hope that institutions will do it on their behalf, you know, like medical centers and the like. When that doesn't happen, the government can legislate to make sure that those things are happening. But I can't stress enough that, yes, you know, we have legislation around, you know, better health, like, but better health education in the provider's space, right? Actually telling providers, you have to provide this information to your patients, to your clients, so they understand their rights, so they understand what they're going to be put through. We do things like that, and there are bills that do that. You know, there are bills around, you know, reporting on what are your outcomes, because you have to be held accountable for the fact that you haven't, you know, decreased this disparity. And that has to be paired with this kind of more ground up providers themselves choosing to take this on in their institutions. And I've been lucky enough to meet with several medical providers in our area who have come to me about concerns they have for their institutions and what they see happening to their patients. And we've worked together on trying to create legislation around how to treat people more fairly. And we'll move forward with that, right? But I think the best thing I can say is we need to listen to the two women who are on this call. They possess these answers. We just have to listen. We have to do it.
Well, keep us apprised of the efforts here, Senator Brooke. Thank you for making time to join us.
Thank you so much.
State Senator Summer Brooke. Dr. Twyla Dillion is Executive Director of Health Connect One. Twyla, thank you for the time.
Thank you, Evan.
And the Executive Director of the Healthy Baby Network is Sherita Bullock. Sherita, a pleasure having you. Thank you.
Thank you.
From the whole team at Connections, it's Emma Ray Stein, it's Rob Braden, Megan Mack, and me saying thank you for listening, and we're back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.